dream on thy cousins smothered in the tower. Let us be laid within thy bosom, Richard, and weigh thee down to ruin, shame, and death. Thy nephew's souls bid thee despair and die.
I can barely speak after that.
Well, out of terror. Because, of course...
You told me. So, welcome, everybody, to The Rest is History. We're doing this podcast about the Princess and the Tower. Tom Holland has absolutely got me here under false pretenses because he told me that he was going to do a devastating impersonation of... of a creepy boy.
They were creepy boys. I mean, I defy anyone to listen to that and not be terrified, scared out of their wits. I can imagine even now that listeners are cowering behind the sofas or under their beds out of dread.
That was wet. That was Fotherington Thomas.
It wasn't. It was terrifying.
It was.
Despair.
Hello, birds. Hello,
despair
sky.
Despair and die. Terrifying. And they were, of course, the princes in the tower, Edward V and his younger brother, Richard of Shrewsbury, who in Shakespeare's play, Richard III, appear to him on the eve of the Battle of Bosworth, along with the ghosts of everybody else that Richard has murdered.
Or has he? Yes.
Well, in Shakespeare's play, he has. I mean, there's no question about that.
Of course he has in Shakespeare's
absolutely.
Play.
Absolutely. It's the actually the second quotation from Richard III that's featured in recent weeks, because we also had one from Clarence's dream before Richard murders him by having him dunked in a butt of Malmsey. On Bart Van Loo's sensational episode about the Dukes of Burgundy. So this is, we've moved from Burgundy back to England. And Dominic, the question that we're asked, well, actually, the theme is Princes in the Tower. But of course, there is the question, which is what happened to them? Were they murdered? And if so, who murdered them?
It is the absolute greatest mystery in English history, isn't it? I mean, it's the one that everybody has heard of. It's the most romantic. It's the one that sort of amateur historians still try to solve. And obviously, well, we shouldn't give away our answer because we do have an answer, don't we? We have
collectively, I think.
Is it fair to say that we've solved the mystery?
I think that might be going too far, but I think we do. We have arrived at a consensus as to who we think did it. And we should say that the focus is on, the title of this episode is Princes in the Tower, rather than Richard III or Henry VII or whatever, because we thought that would be a kind of interesting angle. So, Dominic, the Princes in the Tower, let's look at the eldest of them. Edward, who becomes Edward V, and he is born on the 2nd of November, 1470. And it's not the most propitious circumstances, is it, for him?
No, he's born at a place called Cheney Gates, which is the house of the Abbot of Westminster. It's basically next to Westminster Abbey.
It's above the cloisters, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, I think so. And his mother, so he is the son, 1470, he is the son of King Edward IV and his wife, Elizabeth Woodville. But he is born in Sanctuary because his father has currently fled and is effectively in exile. In the latest twist of the colossal Game of Thrones inspiring saga that is the Wars of the Roses.
Yes. And so his wife, his queen, Elizabeth Woodville, has taken sanctuary there, as indeed she will do again subsequently. And we'll come to that. So there's a lot of people claiming sanctuary in this episode. But you mentioned Wars of the Roses. So let's look at... Edward's two parents, Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville. Let's look at Edward IV first. So, I mean, he has this kind of strange reign. He comes to power and he rules, and then he goes into exile, and then he comes back again. And that's kind of unique, really, in the history of English kings. So he is the son of someone who we mentioned in the 12 Days of Christmas episode, Richard of York, who gave battle in vain.
In a way, this is a kind of sequel to that, isn't it? Richard of York, who died... the Battle of Wakefield, and his head was put on the gates
with a paper crown,
Margaret of Anjou. So in a way, our story picks up straight after that. So Richard of York is the Yorkist claimant to Henry VI's throne. So the English nobility is kind of divided between Lancastrians and Yorkists. And when Richard dies, his claim passes to his eldest son, who is Edward, Earl of March, he was before. Who is this? So he's 18 years old when his father dies. He is
a scrapping lad.
He is extremely. So he is the grandfather. It will of Henry VIII, isn't he? As it turns out, so he's. If you listen to our Six Wives of Henry VIII podcast, he is very, very similar. Actually, his trajectory is very similar to Henry VIII, isn't it? You can definitely sort of see the genetic inheritance because he's huge. You know, what is he, 6'4" or something?
Yeah.
Which is absolutely colossal.
I think we may mention this before. I think when and if William, Prince William, becomes king, he's the only king who will be taller than Edward IV.
Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. May have got that wrong.
But Edward IV is everybody says he is a very, very impressive person.
And he's very affable. He's a massive lad, isn't he?
He is a massive lad.
He likes his food, he likes his drink, and he likes his ladies.
Yeah,
and absolutely. And he likes fighting, and he's very good at fighting.
He's the sort of model, he's an alpha male, as Henry VIII was when his grandson will be when he's young. He's a sort of a roistering, slaughtering, hard-living, hard-drinking, womanizing. Yeah, he's basically lad. He's basically the guy from the university rugby club.
Yeah, he is. He's the president of the kind of college sports society and all that. Yeah,
absolutely, he is. And quite quickly after his father's death, he turns it all around. He wins a couple of battles, most famously the Battle of Towton, which is the bloodiest battle ever fought on English soil. And so by 1461, at the age of, not basically by the time he's turned 19, he's on his way to becoming king, to kicking out the Lancastrians. What does he do? He captures Henry VI.
And he doesn't kill him, does he?
No.
Because,
which is interesting,
Margaret of Anjou and their son, again, confusingly called Edward. I mean, basically everyone's called Edward in this episode, so many apologies. So let's call him the Lancastrian Edward. They've gone into exile, so there's no point in killing Henry VI. And in fact, he's a kind of an insurance policy because he's pretty dilally by this point. So he's locked up in the tower. He's looked after quite well, but he's kind of immured away. And Edward sets about establishing the foundations of his regime.
It speaks well for Edward, actually. He doesn't kill Henry VI.
I don't think it does at all. I think it's pure politics because in due course...
Well, of course, he does kill him eventually. Yeah, but I mean, I think that's reasonable after the Lancastrians have made a comeback.
I think
anyway,
Edward is completely ruthless.
Do you know who he looks like, Tom?
Who?
If you look at the portrait, he has the face of David Cameron.
Which, you know, there is something David Cameron-esque about him in that he's, I mean, he's ostensibly a kind of impressive figure. He wins, you know, he's very successful at winning things, but ultimately he becomes a terrible failure.
All right.
I mean, I hope no spoilers there because.
So, Dave, if you're listening.
No, I agree. Yeah, there is something of that kind of ruddy cheeked, posh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there is it. But I think that Edward IV is a very, very ruthless operator. I think if he has to kill people, he will.
But he'll hug a husky first or whatever it is.
All that kind of thing. So he. He's ruling as a usurper, basically. And so his regime is inherently precarious. There are lots of people who wish him nothing but ill. And so he has to tread very, very carefully. And obviously one of the things that a usurping king, fresh on the throne, has to do, and this is absolutely in the context of everything that Bart Van Leeuwen was saying in with the episode on the Burgundians, is that there are a lot of predatory foreign powers as well as domestic enemies.
Yeah.
And so the key thing that an eligible young bachelor on the freshly minted on the throne of England has to do is to marry advantageously. And that means sourcing himself as a really top quality foreign bride.
Well, the thing is, Tom, to go back to our Bartline Van Loo podcast, England is in this dance, isn't it, with France and Burgundy.
Mm.
So France and Burgundy are the sort of two neighbouring powers, and England is flitting between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes it more complicated, this issue of the bride, is that Edward owes his ascendancy not just to his own sort of strappingness and his martial ability, but to a very, very powerful patron or ally, which is the Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, famously Warwick the Kingmaker. And Warwick is very keen to have an alliance with France. And he spends a lot of time, you know, once Edward is king and then Castrians have been kicked out, he spends an enormous amount of time negotiating an alliance. It's very Henry VIII style. He spends an enormous amount of time in this sort of Thomas Cromwell style enterprise of sorting out an alliance with the French and a marriage alliance and all the rest of it.
And investing a lot of his political capital in this very publicly.
Warwick definitely thinks, you know, Edward is a young man. He's David Cameron. He's my puppet. It's very clear I am the power in England, and getting the alliance and the right marriage for his puppets obviously matters enormously to his sense of status and prestige, which is why
in 1464,
he is
when the news reaches him that Edward, rather than going for a French bride or indeed any foreign bride, has married an English commoner. And not just any commoner, but a woman who has already been married and has two sons already. And this, it cannot be overemphasized, is not how English kings are supposed to behave. So I suppose you could say, I mean, so the person he marries is a woman called Elizabeth Woodville. And basically she's the kind of, so Elizabeth Bowes Lyon.
The Queen Mother,
who marries George VI. She marries him when he is not expected to become king.
That's right. Yes.
So really the only other person who's expected to become king, who's married a commoner, is again Prince William, who keeps popping up in this conversation. So Kate Middleton is...
You've met Prince William. That's presumably the reason why you keep bringing him up. And you're both Aston Villa supporters.
Yes, we had a chat.
Like, as is David Cameron, actually.
That was back when Villa were beating Manchester United.
The three of you should get together and do your own Rest Is History.
Yeah, we should, shouldn't we? We get Nigel Kennedy and Tom Hanks along. It would be great. We could all bleed claret and blue together.
Well, I think the parallel here... So I think the marriage to Elizabeth Woodville...
But Dominic, I just mentioned that because I think it emphasises how weird this is, how odd and exceptional.
I agree with
this
you completely, Tom. And I think the marriage to Elizabeth Woodville is in many ways the absolute most important foundation point for this whole story, for this podcast.
It's a fracture point from which the entire structure will kind of disintegrate.
Exactly. It's so unusual, as you say. Clearly what's happened is that Edward has been... he is motivated by, he's infatuated with Elizabeth Woodville. And I think what is so fascinating
really is
about this whole story.
Tom Totty.
But you know what, Tom? The last time you did that impersonation full force was in our Six Wives of Henry VIII podcast.
Yeah.
And I think what's so interesting about this entire story, about the marriage to Elizabeth Woodville, about the succession of a young boy as king, is the parallels with what happens a generation
later. Because it's a marriage, isn't it? Marriage because, is absolutely like the heart of this whole story.
Because the Elizabeth Woodville is not unlike Anne Boleyn in that she refuses to be, she basically will not be the king's mistress. Edward has a lot of mistresses, but she wants a marriage. Yeah. So he marries her. And that's the point at which, as in the sagas of Henry VIII with the Boleyns and the Seymours and so on, she brings her family, because that's what you do.
Well, hold on. Let's look at her family. So who is Elizabeth Woodville? Her mother is actually quite classy, isn't she? She's Jacquetta.
That's right.
Claims descent from Charlemagne, related to Bart van Loo's Dukes of Burgundy. And she had actually, she'd had a good marriage. She'd married the brother of Henry V, John the Duke of Bedford. But then he dies and she then marries a guy called Richard Woodville, who's basically an elite sportsman. He's common, but he's an elite sportsman. He's a great jouster.
Right.
Yeah, a bit like me, I suppose. But he's basically, I mean, he's not, I mean, even
no,
by the
gentry.
Standards of the English.
He's not an ability.
So even by the standards of English snobbery, he's kind of quite low down the social scale. And really, I suppose that, you know, kind of the intriguing parallel is Catherine of Valois, who had married Henry V, who then marries Owen Tudor. He was her
kind
of court chamberlain.
Yeah, she drops down a bit of a few levels.
Yeah, so kind of similar thing. Jacquetta marries this guy, Richard Woodville, who is a tremendous jouster. And he becomes Lord Rivers. He fights at the Battle of Towton against Edward IV, but his partner.
Yeah, they're Lancastrians, aren't they, originally? And Woodvilles.
Yeah, and so Elizabeth, his daughter, she is also married to a Lancastrian. Sir John Grey, who had died at the Battle of St. Albans in 1461. So back in the Richard of York days. They got two children. And she's basically, she has a kind of predatory mother-in-law, doesn't she? And so she decides to appeal to the king. And she does that in the full knowledge that basically, you know, woof, woof. She's, that she has attributes that will appeal to the king.
Well, she's 28. He's, what is he, 22, I think?
So she's a MILF, I believe.
Oh, God. I can't believe you've gone there, Tom. Oh, well. Anyway, yes.
Well, I think Edward IV is, you know, just to reiterate, he is a massive lad who allows his libido to lead him.
Yeah. She plays her cards as Anne Boleyn does, generation later. Yeah. She basically says, no, I have to marry you. That's the deal. He's like, great, let's do it. And when Warwick hears the news, Warwick is absolutely furious because Edward has thrown away the chance of the marriage alliance. He's made Warwick look like an idiot. But also what's happened is that by introducing the Woodville family, because she brings with her inevitably her brothers, her father, it's all about networks, isn't it? Medieval politics. It's all about patronage networks. She brings in this whole load of people who are going to need offices and lands and everything, and they upset the balance. And actually, that's the, what are we, 1464. So for 20 years, that balance is basically upset.
That's absolutely true. But just to stick up for Elizabeth Woodville, I think she's an incredibly impressive figure.
Oh, I'm not knocking her. I mean, she plays her cards very cleverly.
I think she's a superb queen. So I think the whole thing, so she and Edward get married on May Day, which is, you know, the romantic day par excellence. This is the age when Malory is writing the Morte d'Arthur. There's the great, you know, the great romantic narratives of knights falling in love with ladies. And I think that that provides a kind of context that Edward will absolutely use. But Elizabeth does as well. She's very, very good at playing the gracious queen.
Yeah, she plays the part very, the people who don't like her are their factional rivals. I don't think there's any sense that the public have turned against her.
But Elizabeth herself is very alert to basically how impoverished her husband's court is. He's a massive spendthrift. I mean, he's exactly the kind of guy who blows enormous quantities of money on all kinds of stuff.
Doublets, pies.
So Elizabeth Woodville recognises that she has to look like a queen. So she does. She's very, very happy to spend money on looking like a queen. But otherwise, she makes economies. You're right, of course. It's the problem that she brings all these kind of relatives that is the issue. But she does bring one particularly, I think, tremendously cool relative, who's her brother, Anthony Woodville, who in due course will become...
He's clever, isn't he? He's a great scholar
But again, also a great sportsman. So he's a patron of Caxton, you know, who sets up the first printing press. And he's actually translated a whole compendium of sayings of philosophers from the French that is one of the very first books that Caxton publishes. But he also has this tremendous duel with a guy called the Bastard of Burgundy. Do you know about this?
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah, it's in Bart Van Loo's book.
It's in Thomas Penn's book of the Brothers York as well. They spent about 300 pages organising this massive tournament.
So the Bastard of Burgundy, which comes no surprise to anyone who's heard the episode on the Burgundians, is the son of Philip, the good of Burgundy, who, as Bart reminded us, tended to get a bastard every time he went on his travels. They set up this kind of incredible showcase of jousting, because these are the two, you know, the Bastard of Antoine, the Bastard of Burgundy, is the greatest jouster in Burgundy, and Anthony Woodville has the reputation as the greatest jouster in England, and they have this kind of 2-day combat in London, where basically Anthony Woodville wins. I mean, Edward has to kind of step in and stop it, and he's very, very cool in his tent. He has this phrase, la nonchalance. So he's a very cool guy.
That's very Cameroon, isn't it? To pursue the David Cameron analogy. Oh, come on.
No, he's a kind of laid back, mellow, smart sportsman.
But the thing though, Tom, is that he's very impressive. He's very clever. He's very, you know, he's very cultivated and all the rest of it. But because he's from the parvenu family, that stuff makes enemies. And the thing is, being a medieval king is all about, you don't have absolute power or anything like it. What you have is this very complicated machine and these incredibly convoluted and elaborate and intricate networks of kind of regional loyalties.
Absolutely.
And associations. Yeah. And you upset that at your peril. You know, you need to keep that machine ticking along and basically divvying out the rewards, the offices, the lands, and making sure that everybody's happy. And you know, I mean, you can go down one route and basically pick a side, kill the others or whatever, but then you have to do it really ruthlessly. Otherwise, you have to keep things in balance. And you could argue that, I mean, we had quite a few questions about this. Is Edward IV a failure because he basically allows the system to get out of balance? I mean, I suppose I would argue.
Yeah, so Peter Davies, could you outline Edward IV's failures in allowing such factionalism to lead to regicide, the king who never lost a battle but lost the war?
I think, wouldn't you say, Tom, that such factionalism is inherent in the system? You're always going to have different factions, and keeping them in balance. I mean, Edward keeps them in balance, actually. Well,
quite well.
He makes one very big mistake, which in 1470-71, doesn't he, when the factions get completely out of balance.
Which is the backdrop for why his son, the future Edward V, has to be born in sanctuary. And perhaps we should come to that after a break.
Okay. Right, welcome back to The Rest is History. We are proceeding at a somewhat glacial pace towards the story of the princes in the tower. So we're just approaching the moment where the first prince is going to be born. That's Edward V. So, Tom, we ended just before the break talking about Edward IV and factionalism. And obviously Edward IV is going to, he's in for a shock because he's offended the Earl of Warwick by marrying Elizabeth Woodville. And this is about to blow up in his face. So in 1469, I think, you have the first real signs that the Earl of Warwick has basically allied with Edward's brother, George, who is the Duke of Clarence. And George and Warwick feel very aggrieved at the intrusion of the Woodvilles into the kind of factional machine, and they're starting to get very restive. And you start to get this sense that there's a great cataclysm coming. And then it does come, doesn't it, in 1470, yes. Where Warwick basically changes sides, unbelievably, having been...
As also does Clarence. False, fleeting, perjured Clarence, as Shakespeare said, has it. So Warwick's treachery is, I mean, kind of understandable because Edward has basically shafted him with this marriage in all kinds of ways. Clarence, I think, is less forgivable. But anyway, so Edward, to his astonishment, I mean, it all kind of just melts away incredibly fast. And Edward basically finds that he, despite being king for basically a decade and actually playing the role of king quite well, he's not very popular. Support melts away. And he and his youngest brother, so there are three brothers, Edward IV, George Duke of Clarence, who has sided with Warwick, and the younger brother, Richard, who'll become Duke of Gloucester. In fact, is he Duke of Gloucester by this point? I can't remember. So Richard, who is the youngest brother, doesn't betray Edward, sticks with him. And together they flee England and they go to Burgundy, where Edward's sister, Margaret, has married Charles the Bold.
That's right.
Again, listeners may remember.
The whole thing is taking
the Burgundians
place against the backdrop of this Franco-Burgundian rivalry. So the French are backing a Lancastrian restoration with the Earl of Warwick, and the Burgundians are basically offering Edward IV and his brother Richard sanctuary and time to kind of rebuild their forces. So England is basically prey to some extent to the sort of great power ambitions of France and Burgundy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's with Burgundian support that Edward and Richard are able to return to occupy London. There's a terrible battle that is fought in Barnet in North London, in this in the fog. Richard outflanks Warwick there. There's great slaughter. Warwick is killed.
Well, Warwick is very... Do you know, Tom, I loved Warwick the Kingmaker when I was a teenager, when I was kind of... Well, when I was kind of 11 or 12 when we did this at school. I was a very passionate admirer of Warwick the Kingmaker, and I've always felt he was very unlucky, because don't his soldiers mistake some of their allies in the fog for Yorkists?
They
do. They open fire on them, and it all goes horribly wrong, and Warwick is kind of butchered by Yorkist soldiers, and it's all... To me, it always seemed a great tragedy that this very impressive magnate...
And how do you feel now? You're less of a fan.
I don't care. I don't. Well, I mean, they're all
brutal and horrible, weren't they?
Yeah, they're all exactly. Yeah.
But there's kind of horrible stories of people back in London waiting for news, and people start drifting back, and they've kind of lost their noses and, you know, eyes, and kind of horrible details.
That's medieval battles for you, Tom.
Medieval battles for you. Yeah.
Don't get involved if you want to keep your nose.
And by this point, also, we should say that Clarence has again switched sides and has been reconciled with Edward. So it's
I think it's fair to say, not a friend of the show.
Well, yeah. I don't think you want Clarence as your friend.
No.
Because you know he'd stab you in the back at some point.
He definitely would. Well, he's permanently aggrieved, isn't he?
Yes.
I mean, he really is the sort of...
He
has a terrible sense of entitlement and of victimhood, and everybody's against him.
He's like the one in The Godfather.
He's Fredo. He's actually the classic middle brother, as I think Fredo is.
Yeah. Yes, I think he is. I wonder if that was a kind of inspiration as well, because it's all there in Shakespeare.
Yeah, Al Pacino kissing Fredo, I know.
And Al Pacino made a whole film about Richard III, so who knows?
Yes, he did. Maybe looking for Richard.
Yeah.
It all connects. Get Al Pacino on your Aston Villa podcast with Cameron and Prince William.
Dynamite. So that's Warwick knocked out of the way, but there's still the issue of Margaret of Anjou and her son, Edward, who she sees as the Prince of Wales, and they need to be got rid of. And Edward goes storming off, and they kind of shadow each other up and down the line of the Seven. And they finally meet at Tewkesbury.
Yeah.
And there is
a bloodbath, isn't it?
Absolute bloodbath. And Edward, the Prince of Wales, is killed. Margaret of Anjou flees. And this is when Henry VI is finally dispatched in the Tower.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned that in the first half. I think it's kind of shocking that Henry VI, who is lost his mind and just a sort of doddering, sort of doted, that he's killed. But it completely makes sense that Edward IV does this, because Henry VI is a focus for opposition. You know, the Lancastrians have had one comeback attempt that has failed. It sort of makes sense that Edward IV now gives the order. Basically, as soon as the Battle of Tewkesbury is over, okay, get rid of it, Henry VI.
So in Shakespeare's play, Henry VI, Part 3, it's Richard who does it. It's Richard who murders him.
There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever for that.
Well, there is. Richard is said to have been present in the Tower of London when Henry is killed.
But the Tower of London is a major complex.
Yes, of course.
It's the major kind of complex in London. So, of course. There are probably lots of people present in the Tower,
he is the son, you know, he is the youngest and most trusted brother of the king. I would have thought he probably was complicit in the murder of Henry VI, but
there is
no question that the order came from Edward IV.
There's no specific reason to think that, apart from later Tudor propaganda and Shakespeare, to think that Richard wasn't. I mean, it's perfectly plausible.
I think there is. Of course there is. Richard is Edward's trusted younger brother, and he's present in the Tower when Henry VI is killed. It's a major, major decision. It's a major policy step. I think Richard absolutely would have been complicit in it.
I don't think
the idea that you get in Shakespeare, that Richard comes galloping back from the Battle of Tewkesbury, kind of cackling and limping and dragging his hunchback, and murders him just for the fun of it. I don't buy that kind of model of Richard as a villain, but I do buy the idea of Richard as a ruthless henchman
Where I meet you halfway, Tom. I would say, if Richard wants to be part of the regime, he's 18 years old. If he wants to be part of his brother's regime, and obviously he does, then clearly he's complicit in the decisions taken by Edward IV, as are all the other Yorkists.
Yes.
I mean, basically, all the Yorkist elite must know that Henry VI is about to be rubbed out. They think it's reasonable. You know, they fought this long war. It's madness to keep him on as a sort of focus for opposition. Get rid of him. The idea that Richard would have personally carried it out seems to me implausible. I think
I'm not saying he personally killed him, but that he may well have had a kind of supervisory role. And the reason that I think that actually Richard's role is probably greater than that of, say, other Yorkist henchmen, is that Richard becomes Edward's most trusted partner in rule.
But he becomes his most trusted partner because he went into exile with
absolutely.
Him. Absolutely. Because he's a blood relative.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, he doesn't need to have killed Henry VI for that to be...
I think it's improbable that he wouldn't have done. I mean, it's a key...
Should we just talk a tiny bit about Richard at this point? So he's 18 years old. What we know about him is that he is small, slight. He probably has scoliosis. Not a massive hunchback or anything like that, but... He definitely is not so sort of, to use a Shakespearean word, kind of misshapen that he can't fight in battle and be a very effective warrior. He's very serious. He's very pious.
Yeah.
He has all these religious books that he annotates kind of almost obsessively.
Yeah.
He spends a lot of time in the north. So he's effectively a northerner.
Well, yeah. Well, he becomes it, doesn't he? Because when Edward gets back on the throne, So Clarence and Richard have both married daughters of Warwick,
which has created a lot of bad blood, hasn't he? Because Clarence didn't want Richard to marry a Warwick daughter because he knew it would mean sharing the great Warwick, the Neville inheritance.
And so there is again a kind of fracture point there, which Edward solves by basically giving Clarence, a great chunk of lands, including Warwick's lands in the Midlands, and Richard gets installed as effectively the ruler of the north.
Yeah.
And Richard is much more effective than Clarence. And Clarence ends up, notoriously, he gets put in the tower and as in the Shakespeare, the version in the Shakespeare play is that he gets drowned in a butt of Malmsey. He gets dispatched. But Richard proves himself a loyal and able servant.
Malmsey. Yeah. Do you know what Malmsey is?
It's a kind of wine, isn't it?
Do you know where it comes from?
Malmesbury.
No,
I don't.
No,
I always thought it was Malmesbury.
Malmesbury. It comes from Monemvasia.
Oh, of course it does. Yes, in the Peloponnese.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
of course.
Went to the Monemvasia on holiday last summer.
Did you taste Clarence?
We bought a bottle of it. I have it downstairs in the kitchen. It's a kind of sweet wine. It's very nice.
Is it?
Yeah. There's now a producer in. I should be taking money for this. There's a producer in Monemvasia that is now producing once again. Proper Malmsvassian Malmsey wine.
Clarence. So there you go. The Clarence vintage.
Yeah. 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 Well, in fact, in the shop that was owned by, they sort of muttered something about there was a very famous Englishman who was drowned in it. And I knew the story. So it was a lovely moment anyway. You had to be there.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. So that leaves Richard really sort of unchallenged, doesn't it?
Yeah. And he's a very competent administrator. And he's very pious. And I think all of these are absolutely, it's perfectly possible for him to be a competent administrator, to be very pious, and also, when needs be, to be incredibly ruthless.
Well, because you have to be if you want to survive in the game.
Absolutely. I don't think that there is any inherent contrast there.
Yeah, I agree completely. And it's actually 21st century back projection. To see so many of these people, he's a good guy,
he's
evil.
He's a baddie.
They're all involved in what is a very, very frightening, risky, dangerous business. And they haven't chosen it. They've been born into it and they're stuck in it. There's no option.
Kind of Edward IV has kind of chosen it.
I suppose he has, but most of them.
Yeah,
Richard, let's say, is born in the midst of the wars. It's all kicking off when he was a boy. He's not no real way of escaping it unless he decided to be a monk or something, or to sort of emigrate to Iceland.
Well, I mean, talking of really that, options. Of being born into it, of course, we should go back to the ostensible subject of this podcast, which are the princes in the tower.
Yeah.
So Edward, he'd been in sanctuary with his mother, Elizabeth Woodville, obviously when...
So this is back in 1470, Edward, not Edward IV.
Little Edward.
Yeah.
So he comes out All is well. Edward IV obviously wants to train him up to be as good an heir as he possibly can. And he becomes Prince of Wales in 1471, so the year after his return. And then in 1473, when he is 3 years old, he becomes president of the Council of Wales and the Marches.
I mean, I don't think you need that much experience to live in Wales.
Well, there go all our Welsh listeners. He's based at Ludlow Castle, which listeners to
very
12
castle.
Days of Christmas episode will remember was a particular Yorkist stronghold.
But I'll also remember the castle where Arthur Tudor, Henry Tudor's son, was to die. So this is obviously a standard thing you do.
Yeah.
You send your heir to basically establish your presence in Wales, in the Marches. But crucially, Tom, I think an interesting sort of straw in the wind or a step towards the tragedy that's going to come later. He sends him with Anthony Woodville, that tremendously impressive person that you talked about earlier.
Because he's impressive, I think. I think not just because he's not just because he's a Woodville brother, but because he is he's a kind of classy guy to have as your tutor, because he's very, very learned, but he's also very good at knocking people off horses.
But I think, Tom, crucially, in making that decision, when Edward sends his son with Anthony Woodville, he is kind of ensuring a longevity to the kind of Woodville story, because it means that when his son succeeds him, he will be very close. He will, understandably, be very close to the Woodvilles, and the Woodvilles will clearly going to play a significant part in any subsequent regime.
Well, every king has to divide and rule. So it's always a risk for a king, and Edward knows this because he's already been sent into exile once, that you have to have regional magnates to look after chunks of your kingdom. So you need, you know, our man in the north, our man in the Midlands, our man in Wales. You need that. But at the same time, you can't afford any one of them to build up a monopoly of power. So you have to, if you're a king, create rival power bases. Obviously, Clarence and Richard, as brothers, are absolutely, you know, they have rank and status, and now they've been given regional power bases. The Woodvilles can't possibly rival that. But by giving his son, the Prince of Wales, to be brought up by one of the Woodvilles, Edward is, I think, quite deliberately trying to build the Woodvilles up as a kind of counterpoint to his brothers.
Yeah.
And he's acting on the assumption that he's going to live.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Edward presumably thinks he's going to live to the age of 55 or something. You know, decent age for a medieval king. Possibly he could live 10, 20 years longer than that. So in a way, I suppose you would say, he could outlive Anthony Woodville. His son may succeed when he's 40.
But also, I think it's not just entirely due down to cynicism. I think when you look at the prescriptions that Edward IV gives to Anthony Woodville, it's rather touching, bearing in mind, you know, Edward IV's own character. So he's very, very keen that Anthony Woodville raise the Prince of Wales in virtuous learning.
Yes, love all this.
You know, Woodville has written books about philosophy. He's well qualified to do that, to teach him in sport, to ensure that there's no swearing. And then towards evening, the prince's attendants, Edward specifies, are to enforce themselves to make him merry and joyous towards his bed.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that Edward IV doesn't want his son to be like him, because he says, I want no one in the household to be a swearer, brawler, backbiter, common hazarder, adulterer, or user of words of ribaldry.
Yeah, which is everything.
Which
Edward
basically
is.
Rules himself out. Yes,
which may well be why he's packed him off.
But is that, do you not think there's a, I am so struck by the sort of Henry VIII parallels.
Yeah.
Because Henry VIII is a terribly sentimental, he's both ruthless, but he's also very sentimental. And I think Edward IV is like that too. He's everybody always says how affable he is. You know, his sign is the sun in splendor. One of his mottos is kind of comfort and joy. He's got quite a kind of rose-tinted view of things, don't you think, Edward IV? I mean, I know he's a bastard and he kills people, but obviously when he thinks about his son, he wants his son to kind of, not have anything, and no swearing, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think that's true.
And actually, it goes well, doesn't it? The upbringing seems to go absolutely swimmingly. And everybody says Edward the Fifth, the little boy, is a tremendous little fellow. You know,
and he's got a brother. So I mean, you know, Edward, unlike Henry the Eighth, has absolutely done his duty. I mean, there's actually the brilliant thing when he married Elizabeth Woodville, and his mother Cecily was absolutely furious about it. And Edward's reply to his mother was to say, "Well, neither of us is like to be barren," and that absolutely turns out to be the case. Elizabeth gives Edward, you know, exactly what a queen is supposed to do: a large number of heirs, one of whom is, of course, is Edward, the Prince of Wales, but the other is
Richard.
Richard, who's born in Shrewsbury, who is actually his sixth child, Edward's sixth child, but his
second
son.
And we know virtually nothing about him.
Well, we know that he's made Duke of York in 1474, and then in 1478, when he is, what, five?
He gets married.
He marries the Countess of Norfolk. He's also five. So
yeah, so but also he's widowed quite quickly, isn't he? Widowed by about the age of seven or something.
Yeah, so he's packing it in. He's had an active life.
He's seen a lot of the world.
Exactly.
He's played by Brian Blessed in the first series of The Blackadder.
Is he? It's an alternative reality, isn't it?
It's an alternative reality in which he survives and becomes king.
Yeah. Well, like, yeah, and of course, played by me at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, are you equating yourself with Brian Blessed? Very different voices there. I thought.
I'm the young Richard, and Brian Blessed is obviously the older one. Anyway, so all of this, it all looks to be going well for the Yorkists. The Yorkist regime is absolutely secure. The Lancastrians have been wiped out. The only conceivable line left is the Tudors, you know, this obscure Welsh squire who married a French queen.
As you say, so obscure and so unlikely.
Yeah, doesn't register. So it looks as though the Yorkist regime is absolutely secure, and Edward the Fourth is the model of a king. He's, you know, everything that we've been saying. But the problem is, again, a bit like his grandson Henry the Eighth.
Very like his grandson.
He overdoes it.
Yeah, too much fun.
Too much fun.
So he
gets increasingly fat, again, like Henry. Well, and there's this whole kind of by the 1480s, the early 1480s, he's mutton dressed as lamb. I mean, he's still ordering all these.
That's harsh.
These kind of groovy teenage fashions, but he just looks. I mean, he looks like kind of sausage.
Yeah, people kind of. Well, he's Elvis, isn't he? He's Elvis in the 90s in Las Vegas,
squeezed into his leather or his.
So he has this. He's always been a man for a binge, but there are records, aren't there, of their sort of orders from apothecaries, and he's ordering an awful lot of kind of drugs, but he's also ordering all these emetics that are supposedly he takes during meals,
so that he can stuff them all down. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so that he can have six courses instead of three or whatever.
And Dominic, does it turn out well?
No, it doesn't, Tom. It doesn't turn out well. But the interesting thing is, it's not like people say he's a great balloon, he's going to burst at some point. People are genuinely shocked when at Easter 1483, he falls ill. And there's still nobody really knows what was wrong with him. Some people say he had a stroke. Some people say that he had at some point contracted malaria earlier in his life. We don't know. But anyway, he catches a fever and he dies. And I think this is absolutely crucial for the story. And this is what makes it different from, let's say, the death of Henry VIII, who's also succeeded by a little boy in Edward VI. A key difference is that Edward IV dies very quickly. So within what, a week, a couple of weeks? Mm. So people haven't had time to prepare the ground, to get their kind of networks ready, to work out the balance of forces. So by the 9th of April, he dies on the 9th of April, and his two sons are 12 and 9. And immediately you've got problems.
Yeah, and there are two key people who are not at court when he dies, and that is the young Edward V's two uncles. So Anthony Woodville in Ludlow with the Prince of Wales himself. And, of course, his surviving uncle, Richard of Gloucester, who's up in the north.
He's been fighting the Scots, hasn't he?
So immediately the question comes, you know, the question's raised is, Edward is dead. Edward IV is dead. His son is young. How are all the various Yorkist factions, how are they going to negotiate this youthful king? And that, I think, is a question that we should leave to answer until tomorrow.
Oh, the tension. It's such a cliffhanger, Tom.
It's a huge, huge
I can't believe
tension.
You would do this to the audience. But it's gotta be they
done.
Love it.
Got
to
be done. Yeah. So we will see you tomorrow when we will talk about Princes in the Tower Part 2. When the princes actually will end up in the tower at last.
At least we've managed to get them born and alive.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's something.
Exactly. Right, it's like Tristram Shandy, isn't it? The whole thing.
Yeah.
So we will see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.